Hi, I'm Mary.
And I'm Christy.
And we're angel investors in Budapest, working together on FinTech Factory, an early-stage fintech investment fund backed by MKB Bank.
Each month, we get together to talk about investments and innovation in the financial sector and beyond with experts from around the world.
I'm really excited to have Brian Flynn with us today. Brian Flynn is a serial entrepreneur and investor focused on the software, digital media, and mobile sectors. He runs Founder Partners, which partners with, invests in, and actively helps global technical founders build and exit their companies. Founder Partners has founded and or invested in 30 companies and achieved an 85% success rate of generating profitable shareholder returns. Of those 30 companies, 12 exited, 14 are in a rapid growth phase, and 4 were shut down. Founder Partners has a presence across the US and Europe, and we got to know them recently because they have just made an investment into one of our portfolio companies, Space Invoices. So we're really excited about this next chapter of growth. Earlier in his career, before starting Founder Partners, Brian ran corporate development at Macromedia, where he managed strategy and acquisitions and facilitated the sale of that company to Adobe for $4 billion. He was also an investment banker at Morgan Stanley and Robertson Stephens, where he closed more than 40 mergers, acquisitions, and financings. Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Mary.
So I know I just went through your bio here quickly, but maybe you could take that story off the paper a little and walk us through some of your career highlights. What were the biggest moments of development for you professionally, and what led you to create Founder Partners?
Sure. Happy to do that. You know, I unfortunately was not born knowing that I wanted to be a vet my entire life after petting dogs and turkeys and chickens. I've been a serial learner. In college, I was a philosophy major, so I always was trying to get to truth, but I couldn't quite figure out how to get to my own personal authentic truth, like where I was really supposed to be. As Aristotle would say, what's your telos? What's your end goal? So I think of myself in kind of in a nutshell, basically a banker who turned serial entrepreneur. I learned basically how to sell a business before I learned how to actually build a business. And I was always kind of doing things a little bit ahead of the curve. So being a banker, it was great to be a banker then. That was kind of, those were the best jobs back in the early 90s. And it was, entrepreneurship was for basically the losers, the people that couldn't get jobs. Isn't it funny how things have turned around and nobody wants to be a banker? So yeah, so I did 7 years trying to learn how to sell companies before business school and after business school. The best thing I did, I think, was working at, in that phase of my career, was working at Robbie Stevens. Robbie was one of the four horsemen investment banks from like the 1970s, took all the great tech companies public, even before Goldman and Morgan even came here to Silicon Valley. And at that place, I learned a lot about entrepreneurship, about cap tables, about all these things that are really meaningful. Because when I was at Morgan Stanley beforehand, you know, you kind of work for the VP of treasurers of Fortune 1000 companies, and is so not around entrepreneurship. But after having done that for 7 years, I guess I was inspired in the late 90s. I was running the software and internet M&A practice at Robbie, and my clients inspired me. I was in my late 20s and I was looking at, hey, helping these guys get, you know, essentially rich, or actually more important, fulfilling their dreams of creating and exiting their own businesses. And I thought, well, hey, the grass is greener. Why don't I try it? And so I jumped in, and I jumped in at pretty much about 2 years before the peak of the internet 1.0 bubble. Mm-hmm. And I started my first company.
I was just wondering if you ever considered joining one of these companies that exited before.
No, no. Back
you
in
to
the
do
late night. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Back then, everybody thought they could do it themselves. Everybody who was, you know, 21, 22 years old thought they could be the next CEO. The good news is that I think it was really important in my career, a lot of great mentors along my journey. I was, you know, a lifelong learner. And I've surrounded myself around people who are very successful at what they did so that I can learn from them and I'll ultimately try and help them too. And so, no, I did not join a startup to go work with a founder. I became a founder. And my very first company was called Ultras, and it was identical to what today is called Quora, but probably 15 years before Quora is even started. And, you know, I had a lot of the same issues of, you know, Quora did, right? It's a chicken and the egg. You got to get people asking questions and the right kinds of questions. And you have to have other folks that answer those, not to mention a whole thing, this thing called a business model.
right.
And, you know, I raised money. I had a couple of other co-founders there, and there were some leadership challenges, no doubt. But the smart thing that we did is we pivoted that business for the enterprise. So imagine Quora for the enterprise. because in the enterprise, there's real money there, right? HR would have a budget for tech, for example. And that was a two-year journey pre-revenue. We sold that business for $14 million. Our investors made seven times their money in that time frame. Lots of lessons learned there.
But is it still alive today? I mean,
the product, yeah. So we sold it to a company called Saba that was backed by Sequoia. And it was, you know, back then a unicorn using today's terminology. And it was a renamed Saba Dialogue. And Saba was in the LMS space, learning management system software, which is basically pipeline for training. And this was like kind of a dialogue Q&A knowledge exchange platform for enterprise. Saba, I think, has been bought by Cornerstone or a couple of other private equity firms. So I don't know if the product is still around, but that was like 20 years ago, a little over 20 years ago.
I know. We have so much good stuff to cover with you. Yeah. Yeah, so many lessons here.
Everything was just like story after story and learning and learning and learning. In that particular situation, it was a couple of things. One is figure out what a business model is faster. Number one. And number two, make sure, you know, you get into bed with the right co-founders and make sure everybody's essentially the right, you just kind of got the right team dynamic. Those were the two biggest learnings for sure. But it was great. The other thing I would say learning is, it was just, I think my confidence level was like, you know, it's okay. I took this big risk to go from 7 years on Wall Street. I could potentially do this. Now, the flip side is that I was also nervous about not knowing how to generate real revenues. And that leads me to my second company.
Even after having a $14 million exit, you were nervous?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, because, you know, you can't just, it's not normal, I believe, to build a company where you get to quasi product market fit with no revenues and selling something like that for $14 million. That's just not necessarily normal. I think I also got lucky there because having spent 7 years doing technology M&A and running a practice, I knew how to position companies really well and how to create a competitive process to get a good outcome.
You mentioned that it's very important to find and select the best co-founder. So how did you select yours? Was it a friend or was it a previous colleague or someone that you just, you know, found and was recommended to you?
People that were just recommended me at the time versus now where, you know, fast forward 20 some years later, I know what I'm looking for. You know, I think one of the most important things for founders is to be truly self-aware about what they're good at, what they're not good at. And by the time I did my third company, so I did a second company, I sold a Checkpoint software, I did a third company, actually grew to a very profitable ad tech business. It was closely held to $20 million in revenues and $10 million in EBITDA. By that third company, I really was much more aware of what I was good at and not so good at. And it came down to three things. And this is like kind of laying the groundwork for what today is founder partners. Those three things were, number one, I'm not an engineer. I was a philosophy major. So I was a great learner. And it was just kind of too late for me to learn how to code. Number two, I'm pretty good at operations, but I'm not good enough. I was good at, you know, getting a company to the first 5 to 10 million in revenue by my third company and getting into a company that was profitable. But scaling something up to 50 to 100, that's just a completely different ballgame. And something actually I don't enjoy. I don't really love operations that much and I hate politics. And number three, I'm good at product, but I'm not excellent at it. And in the world that we live in, digital media, internet, software, you got to be lickety-split good. So what I did after I did my third company, I started looking for, let's call them partners. I call them situational partners. Christy, I think you asked the question, situational partners that had two things in common. One, that they had a complementary skill set. So they brought those three skills together. The things I brought together was I was very good as an investor. I could see value super early on, good at finance, strategy, business strategy. As I said, getting a company to ideation, to product market fit, to their initial profitability, things like that. But I needed people that had these other skill sets. And then the second area that I look for, and this is really important and it can't be overestimated, which is the power of shared values. And what I mean by that is really knowing what's important to you as a person 360 in your personal life, your professional life, not have different, you know, fake, you know, auras. But for me, it was integrity It was respect, humility, and a lot of the things that I care about, and I can go a list of like 7-10 different values that I look for in any partner and or in any company entrepreneur. So this was this long journey of A-B testing, what I was good at, not so good at, and really trying to get to know myself as an entrepreneur, as a person, as a husband, father, and all that other good stuff. So it's true authenticity.
So this is how you're getting to founder partners, right? So finding like-minded people with this value set and basically duplicating yourself so you can do the same thing kind of at scale. Is that the idea?
Yeah, basically. I mean, I tested myself even after my third company. I mean, I'd worked at Macromedia. I think you pointed out that was the one time that I took a detour from entrepreneurship. A lot of fun to run corporate development strategy for a really cool company like Macromedia, 2.5-year journey, but it actually reinforced what I was really supposed to be doing, which was go back to entrepreneurship, bet on yourself. I really believe in myself and what I can and can't do. So the essence of founder partners started with this journey of working with situational partners over a period of, let's say, 5-6 years or so. And it's actually funny. I work with about a dozen of them, and 4 of them became billionaires or multi-billionaires, which is just so crazy. Right. And the others are also done really well. And so what
can I work with you?
Anytime, Mary, let's find some more space invoices.
Excellent.
Okay. There you go. No, I mean, what happened is I had this idea that I wanted to create a firm or a place where when I was a first-time entrepreneur that I could have gone to a platform where I could learn from people that had been there and done that before. And so that's really where founder partners came in. Out of those 12 people, one of them became this person named Greg Baszucki, who had this shared vision. The mission was really to help become global technical founders that need business help and want to dramatically increase their probability of success. Because if you look at just entrepreneurship in general, it's usually kind of a 10% success rate. So how could we dramatically change that? Well, the way we do it is we build businesses and we sell businesses. So we have this platform where we have serial founders. We call them builders on the one hand. They've all had exits. And then on the other side of the platform, deal-making folks. These are the earlier versions of myself, folks that maybe had worked doing tech M&A for a while. They went into private equity or they were a CFO or they ran corporate development at Salesforce or, you know, whatever it was. And by stitching these two skill sets together, we're able to kind of cover the full arc of the company build for early stage, growth stage companies. And then it's the way that we work. We come in as minority co-founders to these companies. We also put in our own capital, no, not outside capital, so that we're even much better aligned than a venture firm or sometimes even maybe an accelerator. And we're in it for the long haul or for whatever makes sense for those founders. Some founders actually want an exit pretty quickly. Maybe they've never, we had an example like that. Yahoo came knocking on the door of one of our founding teams only 10 months after starting the company, offered $4 to $5 million. I told them to go pound sand, but with 6 or 7 months later, we sold it for $26 million. And the founders wanted that because they had families to feed, right? Other companies can be on an 11 to 20 year journey. We don't really care. We just care about helping these founders achieve their dreams and compounding their wealth for as long as it makes sense.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And this is part of why I wanted to have you guys on here, aside from the fact that you are taking on one of our companies. But we had a previous guest, Ben Merrill from Briga, and the beginning of what you just said is really similar to his motivation in starting a fund. They're kind of like a VC fund that's run by former founders. But I think founder partners, what's really interesting is I noticed you don't even describe it really as a fund. You call it a platform, or it's an investor club, or kind of an angel group that really gets hands-on, and you have these unique skills that you're bringing to the table. So you're always working for, you know, technical founders, so that bring the maybe the engineering or the product development expertise that's not your strong suit, and then you help them exit using the experience and everything that you've built up. You've worked with 30 companies over the years, and I know you guys don't take on too many at a time. So you maybe do one or two, each of the partners do one or two deals a year, right? So how long do you tend to stay with your companies, or what can you tell us about the pace of how you work with your portfolio?
So Mary, it's all over the map. We at Founder Partners have four different product lines I like to think of. We have an early and a growth stage product line. So the early stage is for these technical founders that have got some level of product market fit defined by usage, customer usage, and or initial revenue streams to a growth product. We just did a deal. We're finishing up a deal in Poland right now. $6 million ARR growing 300% a year, 60% plus EBITDA margins, PLG company. We love PLG. And also coming in as a minority co-founder, but we set a different value on those kinds of companies. The time frame for a company can be anywhere as I've had like two or three companies that have exited within less than 2 years to some I still own. I think one right now I own has like been 13, 14 years or so. So it's, let's say, like kind of anywhere from 4 to 7 years. And if a company is a dividend paying company to exit, those are the best ones, right? I mean, this is not music to the ears of VCs because they actually need to get exits, and they don't necessarily like dividends. They want to keep having founders spend. But what I really like about those businesses is they fully or de-risk the founders who are all in on those companies, and they're starting to realize their IRR along the journey, as well as fielding the optionality if they set in place lots of strategic inbounds. So the answer to your question in a succinct way is it just really depends. So early stage companies that, we can grow into bigger profitable businesses, they're growth companies. We have two from Poland right now. And then what we also do is we make passive investments, and passive investments could just be writing a check. Sometimes it's, people that we've gone to school with or just people that we've heard about, and all they want is just money. And then the last product line is M&A. We, of course, help our portfolio companies, but we also help our non-portfolio companies.
What kind of companies are you looking for?
So I'd say on the early stage companies, probably similar to the growth, but we're looking for companies. Let's talk about the founder first, and then we'll talk about the elements of what I call an attractive business. So the founder to us is 90% of the equation. And the reason why is that a founder in an F market will always beat and crush a B founder in an A++++ market because the A founder will recognize with data, be able to abstract and realize, oh my goodness, I'm in the wrong market. Let's get into the better market and pivot really fast. So what are the attributes of a great founder? Just off the top of my head, we think of folks that are truly humble. The humble founders are ones that learn the best. The ones that are arrogant, they just can't learn because they think they know it all. We like data-driven founders that can adapt to information and listen, founders that have got pure grit because these are journeys of hell. I've been through them and back many times, among many other attributes, but those are some of the key ones. Then there's a whole set of, I call them kind of business criteria that we use and we map across from industry to industry. And let's start with the very nature of the product or service. So if it's a SaaS product, on a spectrum of compelling value proposition where you have a nice to have on the one hand, and on the complete opposite, you've got mission critical. Well, we never want to be in the nice to haves because nice to haves just don't work through economic recessions.
Versus medicine, right?
Yes, painkillers. But let's also talk about, then there's an extreme form of painkiller, mission critical. The problem with mission critical and having run corporate development and macro media is those companies don't scale because it's almost always a buy versus build decision. So what you really want to be is close to that pain point where there's an urgent need to pay repeatedly for that product or service. Second thing that we look for are elements of an attractive business model. Now, we can't check every single box, but we're looking for shaping a business that could have a lot of these attributes. So what makes an attractive business model? I'd say number one, the quality of the revenue streams. Sticky recurring revenues that are high gross margin. We like high gross margin businesses, particularly because you've got more flexibility in the P&L to invest in R&D, sales and marketing to protect the business itself. We love PLG companies where the product is so darn good that it's actually selling itself and so is the community. That dramatically increases the capital efficient businesses. And so when we're putting our money to work, you know, as opposed to putting other monies to work, you know, like VCs, you know, it's better. We'll just get better returns on that investment. So not people intensive businesses. That's another area. So we talked about compelling value prop. We talked about an attractive business model, market sizes and the attributes of a market. I mean, we love, you know, $5 billion plus markets, not necessarily $100 billion. I mean, that's great if that's the case. But, you know, for every point of market share of a $5 billion market, that's $50 million in revenues. We like markets if you use, you know, Michael Porter's five forces, if you need to use a business school concept. There's not too much supplier or customer concentration. These are highly fragmented markets where you can build a really great sustainable business. So for example, one of our companies is a vertical cloud-based workflow in the dental market. It's called iDentalsoft. And the reason why we like that is the unit economics are super attractive. There are about 150,000 dental offices in the United States. 85% of them are, you know, onesie-twosie shops. And once you get the office, the dental office, onto this product, this practice management system, they'll stick around for, like, you know, the next 20 to 30 years, because that's the way it worked in the client server space.
That's so good to hear, because we have a portfolio company that does exactly this in Hungary. And they just launched a couple of years ago and took over 22% market share. So I hope that their customers stick with them for 20 years. That's great.
Yeah. No, they do. And so you got to when you do your due diligence, you start observing these things. And, you know, look, we look for other business things like high barriers to entry, brand, and blah, 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 blah. But you can't have everything. But to answer your question, that's what we generally will look for. And if the companies don't have it, how do we help them exhibit these attributes? Because if you do so, you'll get a great return on investment.
Yeah, I love this answer. It's like a blueprint for success, basically. So here's what you should be looking for. So you come in as a minority founder, but it's kind of a mix of sweat equity and cash based, right? Because you invest some of your own money. But I think this is also really cool and different. Does everybody invest in every business, or how do you decide who works with who?
We have 10 builders right now and 4 advisors, so 14 people, and we're continuing to grow. In fact, if maybe this is an ask, I'd love to get some really cool serial founders to join the founder partner team, because we want to build something that's truly global and decentralized over time. And I actually believe that at some point, entrepreneurs in their career, they want to transition from being a player all the time to being a coach. Mm-hmm. And we've got an awesome platform to do that. And they want to learn, they want to be in the trenches, but not fully in the trenches. They want to support the CEOs. But Mary, back to your question, I want to make sure I understand it. Like, how does it really work? Like, as a minority co-founder, and how do you decide the money? How do you figure out the team that's going to be for each company? Is that where you're getting at?
Yeah, that's super interesting.
Yeah. So the first thing we look at, so, you know, do we like the founder and the companies that kind of map to what we've seen? We don't operate out of FOMO, like fear of missing out. So we tend to take anywhere from 2 to 5 months. In the case of Space Invoices, I believe that our team had spent maybe close to a year with Boss John on and off.
Yeah.
I'd seen how he has. So that's the first thing. And we observe, and they get to observe. The founders get to observe. How do we think? That's a little bit longer than normal. But I think that Boss John, probably we weren't ready for each other at the time. That's the first thing. The second thing is, do we have the right team? And so the primary, secondary builder, do they have expertise in the space? Number one, do they have the time and the availability to do it? Like, they're not overstaffed on other projects. And three, is there a good chemistry and fit? Because these are marriages. These will last for a long, long time. And once we get through kind of an organic process, then we set the terms, and then certain companies will need different levels of capital. You know, we'll invest anywhere from 50,000 to up to 2 million. Of our own money. And, you know, they tend to be a little bit on the lower end, because we want to get these companies to profitability fast. In the case of API services, we have another company from Denmark. I'll give you an example. It's called AdEvent. Started out as an API service, then moved to a SaaS business. It's all around calendaring APIs and SaaS products. They just introduced a new product that competes with Calendly called Appointment Thing. Mm-hmm. But that business didn't require very much capital. And Greg and I, we were the original founders and founder partners, came in as primary and secondary on that business. Michael Nielsen, the Danish founder, he's a brilliant product person, moved here to San Mateo, and we helped him grow it. And now it's growing about 70% a year. It's about 60% EBITDA margins. We don't disclose the full revenues, but in the very attractive single millions of revenue, and it's going to continue. I think it can become a very big business. But, you know, other companies will require more capital. And the capital comes really just from founder partners. And then the way that we work with these companies is just like being a partner, being a minority co-founder. We meet with our teams, the primary and the secondary, with the founder CEO, with Boss John. They should be meeting every week for probably 2 hours, right? An hour to 2 hours. And they cover marketing, sales, product development, competitive budget, KPIs, you name it. And then the CEO actually should be setting the agenda. And then our team goes out and they do work during the rest of the week. They work, roll up their sleeves and work for Boss John. And then there's capital. So I think in the case of Space Invoice, I don't know how much is going in, but our team is also putting in some capital in that company as well.
Awesome. Yeah, and Boss John is the founder of Space Invoices for anybody that's tuning in and doesn't know. So we're really excited for him to have this journey now with founder partners. Brian, this was so great. We are approaching the end of time here, but is there anything else you wanted to share with our audience? Any last pitch for why a startup should try to work with founder partners?
I'd say the first thing is, look, the world is flat. And I'm a big believer that talent exists anywhere and everywhere. And there are opportunities like there's never been before to build global technical companies. And I want founder partners to be part of that for the long haul. We're trying to build the next Goldman Sachs of a completely different category. It's never been created before. And so I'm pumped about that. I'd say that, you know, if you're looking for, why would you join an accelerator? You would join an accelerator, I believe, here, the famous ones that are here in the US, because you want to learn how to pitch a business and you want to raise capital. If you're looking for venture, that can also be great too. And you want a brand name, go for it. We also bring, you know, because our combined balance sheet is pretty large. We've had some really big wins, like Roblox has been one. My co-founder, he's one of the larger shareholders of that company, and, you know, several others. But we like to go after, I call them Mustangs, not necessarily unicorns. The Mustangs are the companies that exit between 20 to 100 million. That's probably not as necessarily as interesting for VCs. But if you're a scrappy bootstrapper type founder like we are, and you own, you know, 50 to 70% of your company, exiting in that range is pretty darn good. And then maybe if you really feel compelled, you want to go build that next big unicorn, go for it. We can hopefully still be part of that journey. If you want to learn how to build a business, it's a very different thing. Come to Founder Partners. Yes, we bring the capital, but we're in it for the long haul.
I love it. So for builders and founders that find something exciting about the Founder Partners model, get in touch. All right.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the time and the opportunity, both of you.
Thanks for listening.
Tune in next month for another episode of Beyond FinTech, where we discuss the latest trends in investing and innovation in the financial sector and beyond.